The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, good evening, everyone. Oh, come on, you got to do better. Good evening, everyone. All right, we have to get you ready for Sarah. And for those of you who don't know me, my name is Siobhan Reardon. I'm the president and director here at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and it's good to have all of you. And I see my very special friends here. We are here to welcome the fantastic Sarah Gruen, who took the literary world by storm in 2006 with her breakthrough bestseller, Water for Elephants. But before we get to see Sarah and talk with Sarah tonight, as many of you know, the Free Library provides essential services to thousands of Philadelphians throughout the year. And with Mayor Nutter's recently reactivating the Mayor's Commission on Literacy here at the Free Library, our focus now more than ever is on tackling the growing illiteracy crisis our city faces. More than half of the adult population in Philadelphia cannot read well enough to navigate a simple job application. And your support now, more than ever, to the Free Library will help ensure that we are well-equipped to improve literacy rates that lead Philadelphia into a more prosperous 21st century. I have to ask you to silence your cell phones. That's an absolute requirement. Shut them off. And I want to make sure that you know that we have a book signing right after Sarah's talk tonight upstairs in the lobby. Sarah Gruen is the number one New York Times bestselling author of Water for Elephants, Flying Changes, and Riding Lessons. A devoted animal lover, she draws readers into the animal world through stories where fiction is closely aligned with facts drawn from her own meticulous research. In her new novel, Ape House, she writes about the family of language-competent apes that are stolen from a language laboratory and turns up in a reality television show. A Red Book quote describes the book very succinctly. Gruen delivers a tale that's full of heart, hope, and compelling questions about who we really are. The book hits the New York Times bestseller week next week, New York Times bestseller list at number 8 next week. Let's give a big Philadelphia welcome to Sarah Gruen.
I need your hair.
Okay.
Just your hair.
Okay.
Okay. Hello. Whoops. I'll try not to do a header. Thank you for coming out. Apparently there's a game of some sort going on. So I really appreciate it. I'm just going to launch right in. I got the idea for this book about 4 years ago when I was on tour for Water for Elephants, or around about that time. And my mother sent me an email with a link to the website of the Great Ape Trust. And I spent a couple of days poking around at their site and was doubly fascinated. The first reason is that I have always been very interested in the idea of language competency in apes and language acquisition, and have been following the story of Coco the gorilla for longer than I really care to admit, 1980. But also I'd never heard of bonobos, and they're a very special type of ape. They're the most recently discovered of the great apes. They used to be thought of as simply a subspecies of chimpanzee, but they are in fact their own species. And although they're very physically similar to chimpanzees, except that they have black faces and pink lips, longer, slightly more elegant limbs, so they kind of look like the ballet dancers of chimpanzees. But the way that they act is very not chimpanzee. They are matriarchal, egalitarian, and they have lots and lots of sex. The average bonobo initiates some kind of sexual contact every hour and a half. So I really wanted to go and meet these apes and talk to them. I decided on the spot I had to write the next book about them. There was just too many possibilities there. But a lot of people want to go meet these apes, and it's not very easy to get in. So they made me jump through flaming hoops and do a lot of research on language acquisition and all of these studies that have been going on since the 70s, teaching various types of ape sign language or using lexigrams and things like that to communicate in human language. And then also I had to fly to Toronto to York University. I shouldn't say have to. I did fly out to York University in Toronto and spent some time with the two linguists there that are working with the data from the Great Ape Trust. And I never thought that I would use the words linguistics and fun in the same sentence, but I had a blast. It was really great. And when I left there, I went to the bus stop, but I really wanted to go to the enrollment office and start life again as a student because I was so fascinated. Well, I earned my coveted invitation to the trust finally, and got there and discovered that although I was there and had flown out, it didn't mean I was going to get to meet the ape, because that part is up to the apes. These are not zoo animals. They're not on exhibit. This is their home. And so they get to dictate who comes and goes. And I did know about this ahead of time. So I went and stacked my odds as much as possible. I bought each ape a backpack and stuffed it with everything I could think of that an ape might find fun or tasty. So that was Mr. Potato Heads, Slinkies, Rubik's Cubes, Bouncy Balls, and most importantly, M&Ms. If you ever meet a bonobo, M&Ms, and you're in. So I sent an email to the scientists saying, could you please tell the apes that I'm bringing surprises? And so when they went back to ask the apes if I could come in, they came back and said, not only can you come in, they're insisting. So the first ape that I met, the first bonobo that I met, was Kanzi, who is kind of a rock star in the language competent ape world, and he knows it, and he plays up to that. So he came in and he talked and he played music, and they use a unlike in my book where the apes are using sign language because they're not in their home environment and I needed to have their language skills or language tools literally on hand. These apes use a system of lexigrams, which are pictorial representations of words, and they have on their board, I think, close to 400 symbols, and they understand many, many more spoken words than they are capable of saying on the lexigram, just simply because they are limited by the number of lexigrams. And an interesting thing, I'm sort of rambling a little bit, but I do that. Kanzi did not have a lexigram on his board for kale, and he wanted kale. So he referred to it as slow lettuce because it takes so long to chew. And when I had, and I'll get to the tea party a little more later, but when Pambanisha was telling me which cookies to eat, there was basically a vanilla Oreo. There was a stuffed vanilla cookie that she referred to as a bread surprise because she didn't have a lexigram for it. So Kanzi did his thing, and then I met Pambanisha, and she's a little more careful about who she talks to, and not everybody makes the grade, and she waits until she's sure of you. And I also knew this. She's arguably more language competent even than Kanzi, but I had brought a couple of pictures with me as icebreakers because I'd never spoken with a ape before and I didn't know how to get going. I knew that Pambanisha hated cats and liked dogs, and I knew that she was a mother and I'm a mother. So I brought a picture of my dogs and I brought a picture of my kids when they were much younger, all piled together in a very big bubble bath. And I held up the picture to show her of my dogs. Nothing. I held up a picture of my kids, and she punched into her computer. And a synthesized human voice says the words when they push them on the computer. She said, "Baby's washing bubbles." And that was our first conversation, and it was really, pretty incredible. And I have to tell you that, I've been back, I think I've visited 7 times now, and although that first day was amazing to me, it's really over time I've created a relationship with them, and now they're downright chatty and make plans for my visit. When I first left, the day after I left, Pam Venetia said to the scientists, "Where's Sarah? Build her nest. When is she coming back?" And so I sent them a Fruit of the Month club so that they would keep the invitation open. And so once a month they get Sarah's special fruit. And the next time I went, they had known for several days that I was coming. And they also knew that Pam Benicia, the book was being dedicated to Pam Benicia. And Pam Benicia knew this. And so for once, she was the star of the show instead of Kanzi, and she knew it. And she was absolutely milking it. They had been declared overweight, and so they were having diets on Tuesdays and Thursdays. This was a Tuesday. When I got there, Pam Benicia declared that we were going to have a tea party in the forest. And I was there with a film crew, and I was getting my makeup done outside, and she heard that I was getting my makeup done and wanted her makeup done. So the makeup girl climbed over the barriers, and we went in and back, and Pam Benicia and I got our makeup done. She put on very beautiful purple lipstick, and she powdered her cheeks, and she brushed her hair, checked her teeth. Then I went and waited. She's a slow cook, but she's a good cook. I went and waited while she made the tea. She has her own kitchen. She has a gas range. She made the tea. She cooks ramen noodles. So she made the tea. She spread out the blanket. She made Earl Grey for me and Blackberry for herself. And because she knew I'd been coming, she'd been saving her cookies for a week so she could share them. That's another thing they do is food sharing. They're utterly unlike chimpanzees who will sell their soul for a raisin. So we got out there, and I'm sitting there. We're sipping tea out of fine bone china. And they have when she's out in the forest, the lexicogram boards that they carry are just laminated paper. And so I had scientists there to interpret, help me, because I can't. It's hard. I tried so hard to learn this lexicogram board. And if you want to have a look at it, if you go to the Great Ape Trust's website, there is an interactive version on it. I'm not sure how easy it is to find, but it is there. So if you Google it hard enough, you'll come up with it. And you'll see that these are not representational. I mean, the sign for surprise is a blue background, a white circle, and a white squiggly through it. So these aren't, you know, intuitive for me. And I was lucky if I could find three or four words of my own sentences to do it on a lexicogram board. And so I had someone there to tell me what Pam Benicia was saying with the lexicogram board when she wasn't using the one that was attached to the computer. So she asked me if I wanted some milk for my tea. I said, yes, please. She handed it over, took some, I gave it back, and she went, glug, drained it. Then she told me which cookies to eat and which ones to dip in the tea. And this was the bread surprise we ate first, and then candied ginger, and then there was another one. And then she asked if I was finished with my cookies. And I said, sure, I think I am, and handed her the plate, and she went and finished off the cookies. And then I think maybe she felt bad. So she went off into the forest, and she got me a branch, a carefully selected branch of leaves. And I watched one of the scientists eat a leaf, hoped that they weren't faking it and that it wasn't a poisonous thing, because I sat there and politely ate my brows, which is the term for it, and really would have been a lot better with olive oil. And then Pam Benicia asked me if I'd had a boiled egg for breakfast. And I said, no, but I had one yesterday. And she said, the Easter was by recently and hid eggs in the forest. And she looked thoughtful. And she added, I wish the bunny would come back. There's a guy in the background in a walkie-talkie, and 5 minutes later, the Easter bunny traipses out of the trust and hides more eggs. It's a pretty good gig being a bonobo at the trust. So as wonderful as it is to read about it and in the research books and so on, there's absolutely nothing that can prepare you for the experience of conversing with an ape that can segue from asking you what you ate for breakfast to requesting the return of the Easter bunny. It's pretty amazing. And my last visit, which was, I think, 11 days ago, Pam Benicia asked me, as I was leaving, I said, I have to go back to my own nest now. Oh, she asked me to bring my family this time, so I had the kids in there. It was really, we had a lot of fun. It was a very big honor. I don't think a lot of kids get to go in there. But as I was leaving and I was saying, I'll be back later, not soon, later. I have to go home to my own nest and all that. She asked me if I would bring her a new Mr. Potato Head when I came back. And that was astonishing to me because that was 3 years ago that I brought her the Mr. Potato Head. And that she remembered it was, to me, pretty amazing. And that she remembered that it was me who brought it. I could go on and on about them forever, and I probably will in the question and answer part of this. But I'm going to set up the book a little bit and do a relatively short reading because I think that probably the last thing people want is to sit and listen to people read when you're going to go home and read it yourself anyway. The book, the family of bonobos in the book is based on the family of bonobos at the Trust, except that they use American Sign Language. The people are less civilized. And I have a look at tabloid journalism and the kind of celebutant culture that we're living in and the world of Twitter and Facebook and instant media communication that allows us to have a false sense of intimacy with these people who are considered celebrities perhaps for no better reason than having released a sex tape or leaked a sex tape. But it also allows us to secretly enjoy the train wreck that inevitably happens when they crash. And we can do that from the anonymity of our computer. Nobody watches us do it. But it seems to me that it's revealing a side of us that may have always been there and been latent, but now suddenly, there's this, the gossip blogs and so on are actually really damaging legitimate media because people are not going to newspapers and other real news sources for news. They're going to some of the many horrible places on the internet. So I think in the introduction you heard that the apes end up in a reality TV show. But they disappear. They are gone after the explosion that rocks their world and gravely injures their main caretaker. And nobody knows where they are for several months. And if I can find the page. At this point, still nobody knows where they are. Bonzi crouched in a dark corner with Lola clinging to her chest. She was the first to hear the jingling of keys and screeched a warning to the rest of her family. The men were back. The fluorescent lights flickered spasmodically and then finally buzzed to life. In the cage opposite Bonzi and Lola, Sam screamed and sprinted around the small confines of his cell. He stopped a sign, "Bad visitor, bad visitor," then leapt onto the front of his extruded metal cage and shook it violently with hands and feet. When he jumped backwards, his right thumb was bleeding. Oblivious to the wound, he perched near the front of his cage, hair bristled, head cocked, on full alert. The other bonobos sat waiting, watching. Human footsteps followed, heavy-soled steps that echoed in the concrete hallway. As they approached, panic flooded Bonzi's body. She could never see them until they were immediately outside her space. Jelani, Sam, and McKenna were in cages across the aisle from Bonzi, so she could see all of them and they could see her, but they could not see each other because the walls between them were concrete. Nobody could see Mbongo, but they knew he was there. He was the only member of the family out of sight of all the others, and the strain of the situation was clear in his vocalizations. The clomping got louder until the men came into sight. There were two this time. Bonzi recognized only one. He was the food giver, coming through the halls twice a day to slide trays of tasteless, homogeneous pellets through the slots in their cages and refill their water with a hose. He never made eye contact. He never spoke to them, but was always in deep, angry conversation with some invisible other. The second man was new. He had light hair, gray eyes, and a crooked, joyless smile. "These look like chimps," he said. "You're the one who wanted them," the food man said. The stranger turned his gaze upon him. I'm just saying, said the food man, lowering his eyes. We could have got chimps a lot cheaper. The alpha male, having asserted himself, stood with hands on hips and did what Bonzi could not. He moved his eyes across her family members and evaluated them. Are they eating and whatnot? He said. They appear to be. Pears, signed Bonzi. Good pears. Bring pears. Because I want them to look healthy. They can't appear to be mistreated. The alpha male crouched down outside Bonzi's cage and looked her straight in the eyes. Which one is this? Is this the matriarch? Me, Bonzi. Bonzi, me, she signed. Give me pears. Eggs. Good eggs. Sam hurt. What the hell is that? Is that some kind of monkey voodoo? It's creeping me out, said the food man, averting his eyes. Bonzi held the alpha male's gaze and raised her left hand in a fist, which she flicked off her ear. Then she bounced her pointed index fingers off each other in front of her chest. Shut up, Ray. She's trying to tell us something. Sam hurt, repeated Bonzi more urgently. Sam hurt. Need good pears. What the hell is she doing? Said the non-dominant. The alpha continued to watch Bonzi, who repeated her assertions in ever more urgent motions. She's saying something. What? I don't know. Bonzi, out. Key. Gimme. Hurry, you. Non-dominant's voice rose. I don't like it. It's not right. Are these things even natural? Are they genetically engineered or something? Anyway, aren't they supposed to have sex all the time? They haven't done it once since they got here. They're caged separately, you imbecile. The food man shifted from foot to foot, looking uncomfortably up and down the hall. But you wait, said the alpha. This is going to revolutionize everything. He leaned closer to the cage. Are you my girl? He whispered. Bonzi, whose response for no was simply not to respond, remained still. You're my girl, aren't you? He repeated. His voice was a hiss of rank breath between his teeth. Bonzi stayed motionless. I'm going to move you soon. He rose and addressed the other man. Come on, let's go. On his way past, he double-whacked the front of Sam's cage with an open palm. The clash reverberated through the cement hall, and Sam shrank into a corner.
Thank you.
When I first started writing this book and I put the apes in a reality TV show, I thought that it was going to be sort of a stretch for people to believe it. And then the Jersey Shore started. So, anyway, I think I'll take questions now. I have a lot of fun with question and answers, so if that's good, great.
So I think you know the way this works. Raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you, and you can ask a question. Who'd like to start us off? Gentleman in the third row.
Where exactly is the Ape Trust located, and to what extent are these apes learning new words, new lexicons, and who's teaching them? What's the program is taking place?
That's a really great question. I'm glad you asked it. The first part of it is the trust is located in Des Moines, Iowa. The program, the way that the apes are learning, they're not actually being trained or taught, was kind of an accidental discovery, but a real watershed. The first bonobo that they had was named Matata, and she lived in the jungle until she was 8. So she was a fully mature, bonobo culture ape, and they spent 2.5 years trying to teach her lexigrams, like doing it the old way, that sort of didactic flashcard method. And she had an infant hanging off her head and climbing on her shoulders and basically making life difficult for the researchers, but they couldn't separate them. And I think over the course of the 2.5 years, Matata managed to master, and I may actually be overestimating the number, but no more than 8 lexigrams. And they took her away temporarily to get pregnant again. And Kanzi, her son, spent the first day looking for her and just sort of peering around corners and looking under blankets, and he didn't really believe that she was gone. And she'd always negotiated everything for him, so he didn't actually have to communicate. When he realized that his mother was gone, he went into a full-blown panic, and it turned out that he had learned all of the lexigrams on the board. And it seems so obvious. This is how we teach our children. This is how our children acquire language, through exposure early, through that really short an important language window. And so if you get an infant bonobo and you expose it to language, it will acquire it out of a desire to communicate. And that's exactly how we learn. And it seems to me, you know, that that should have been obvious to everyone from the beginning, but it just was not. It was not the way that this particular scientific inquiry began, but this is the way that the trust has been working. So Matata, to this day, is not language competent. She actually passes her requests through her children, because bonobos absolutely have their own language. They communicate very specific information through vocalizations. For example, Kanzi is a great stone napper. He makes knives. Pambanisha is not very good at it. So the thing with the stone napping, the reward is that they have a treat, usually M&Ms, in a drum with a tight skin across the top, and they give them the stones, and you make yourself a little knife, you cut the skin, you get the treat. Pambanisha, not being so good at this, Kanzi hid the key when he was finished making it. He hid the knife. And when Pambanisha got into the room, he, from another room, screamed something at her, and she went straight to the location of the hidden knife and got her treat. So Matata communicates through the other bonobos, but it's what's really interesting is that they have a new baby. I think he's not even quite 4 months old yet. And they've got a baby-sized lexigram board for him, and they're already going. And he's a pill. He's really great. But this is a third generation, bi-species, bi-cultural ape. And so it's going to be very exciting to see what happens with baby Tico.
Can humans understand their language? Does it work?
Well, that's what the guys at York are doing. They're trying to know. And I think it's really funny that it's what does it say that they've come to our side? We can't manage to go that way.
They might not be able to teach us.
Yeah, well, maybe they don't want to.
Another question? All the way back there.
What is their native land? Where do they normally live?
The bonobos only exist in the wild in a small... Well, basically, it's the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And that is why they were the last of the great apes to be discovered, because they're also very good at going undetected. They travel silently in the canopy. But there really aren't very many of them, and they're in a very dangerous part of the world. So... The biggest threat to bonobos, the only threat to bonobos, is humans. They are hunted for bushmeat. The technique usually involves shoot the mother, take the baby, and then sell the baby on the black market as a pet. So there is an orphanage that I support and have actually adopted all of the infants there, but that doesn't mean you can't adopt them too. It's called Loliya Bonobo, and they take the orphan babies who've been plucked from duffel bags in the Paris airport and from all sorts of horrible conditions, and they send them to this orphanage where they get nursed back to health and then get moved into progressively older groups. And when they're old enough, they are being released into a protected part of the jungle, and they're doing a lot of work with the local people to try and but basically help their circumstances. I mean, it's they have no protein sources. And so although I think of it as darn close to cannibalism, you know, when your kids are starving, you do what you have to do. So educating the people, ensuring that they have enough resources to not need bushmeat, and just basically maintaining the bonobo population that exists and hopefully letting it increase. If that doesn't happen, then we're going to lose them. So it's important work.
Gentleman in the middle, in the green. You can keep your hand up, sir.
Thank you. Hi, Sarah.
Hey.
You enjoying Philadelphia?
Yes.
Good. Welcome. I'm very happy that they decided to take Water for Elephants, make it into... cinema piece, and I'm wondering whether you think there might be a chance of that happening with this book, and if so, can I be in the movie?
I haven't heard anything about about a film option for this book yet. This book will be harder to do because they would have to do CGI for the ape part, and that's apparently extremely expensive. But it's the only option. Not only are there no apes in the entertainment business, but I would not sign a contract that would allow them to be used in the movie. But yeah, the Water for Elephants film was a lot of fun, and I have a cameo.
And again, back in the middle, the lady with her hand up.
I wanted to know more about the process of the research that you did that enabled you to get to the habitat, and mm-hmm. what it was that finally turned the corner for what made them decide to let you in that research process. If you can just right. give a little more detail about that.
Oh, sure. Well, they said that they were open to the idea, but I had to read, and they sent me the list of books and articles and things that I had to read, and then also required that I go to York University I'm glad they did, because these guys are really enthusiastic and were able to explain to me, you know, in fairly great detail what the science is and what they're doing. So it gave me a really good background. I think they probably give this list to everybody and just nobody else does it. So I basically just wrote back and said, okay, I've done it all. I've read all the books. I've been to York, you know, and the guys at York recommended that I be allowed to come. And so that's how I got in. I think they didn't make Paul McCartney do that, though, somehow.
Can you talk a bit about Philadelphia in the novel and how that...
Oh, sure.
The impetus?
Yeah. You haven't read it yet, but one of the main characters starts out as a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the newspapers are in terrible shape right now and laying people off all over the place and going under, and so he's sort of a victim of this and a very, ambitious co-writer. And so he suffers one humiliation after another when she takes his story away from him, until he finally ends up quitting in disgust or taking the early retirement package, even though he's 35. But he can't let go of the story. He really wants to follow the story, and so he wants it so badly that he essentially sells his journalistic soul and, moves to LA, where his wife is, who is a struggling novelist and has decided to take on a job as a screenwriter for what is initially a ripoff of Sex and the City, and then gets changed to the point where it's really now a ripoff of Gossip Girl. But so they both suffer these awful humiliations, but he ends up working at the seediest of tabloids and still trying to inject some journalistic integrity into it. One of my best friends, and in fact my critique partner, comes from Philadelphia and was a reporter at the Inky. And so that I was able to get, you know, a lot, I picked her brain a lot. And so that informed it. And, this doesn't have anything to do with the books, but, Pats and Geno's? Definitely Pats.
Right here in the front row, or second row.
Hi, Sarah. When you're writing a book, what kind of schedule do you follow? How do you discipline yourself? Do you work 9 to 5 Monday through Friday and take the weekends off? Or how does your schedule work?
I take full advantage of school hours. School is the best. I go to work as soon as I wake up, because my brain is working on my stories as I sleep. And so the further I get away from when I wake up, the further my ideas are from me. So if I start at 8 and stop at 10, I'll have done more that day than I ever could if I started at 12 and went to 6, for example. So other than that, it's a whole lot of, you know, sweating blood and hitting my head on the desk and moaning and screaming at people for chewing too loudly and, you know, that kind of thing. But It's hard to, I'm a great believer in the seat of the pants writing theory, which is basically keep the seat of the pants in the seat of the chair. Because if you only write when you're inspired, you'd never finish anything, or at least that's true of me.
In the back there, lady in the green.
We all loved Water for Elephants. I passed it along to everybody, and I'm about to send it to Germany. But I have two questions. Why do the lexicograph instead of the sign language? What's the advantage? And also, when you brought your children, did they respond differently to children? And how did your children respond to them?
The lexicograms were actually kind of a holdover from an experiment that they were doing when the apes were still in Georgia, and they were using the lexicograms as a way for children who don't have language, aphasic children who have no way of communicating with their voice, using the same lexicogram board to help those children gain some language, and it actually works. It's really quite amazing. So that's why I think they chose the lexicograms. But then when they moved over to Des Moines, it was just what the apes knew. For me, the ASL was simply because I needed to have my apes have their language tools with them in the reality TV show. Oh, and my children, yeah. They did actually. Kanzi, for example, he loves to play tickle chase. They all love to play tickle chase, and Yoda is sort of the teenage boy, and he's really into Spider-Man and Harry Potter. So we brought him a Spider-Man t-shirt, but Kanzi likes to actually make people play tickle chase in front of him because he's a little older and he doesn't have all the energy anymore. So he sits back and he says, "You, chase you." And so he was doing that with my family. And he comes up and he kisses the glass so I can kiss him. And so he invited my youngest, who's 9, and so obviously a juvenile, over, and he asked for a kiss, and Daniel kissed him. And then he invited my 12-year-old, who's taller than me, over to the glass, and he made like he was asking for a kiss. And then when my son kissed the glass, he went, "To the glass." And it was like, no, this is my baby. I know he's bigger than me, but he's my baby. And he did the same to Benjamin, my oldest. So for the 12 and 16-year-olds, until they grasped the concept that these were actually my children, and in bonobo society, babies can do no wrong. They are actually the top of the hierarchy, another thing that's very different from chimpanzees. But I have a great picture at home of the 5 of us gathered around Kanzi, all of us tickling, and he was laughing so hard I could hear it. You know, they usually laugh silently. It's unmistakably laughter, but this time he was laughing so hard we could actually hear it. He was just having a ball. So it was a lot of fun.
So we're a little pressed for time this evening, so unfortunately we only have time for 2 more questions. So we'll take the one lady in the green there and then the lady in the center here.
Thank you. Do the bonobos ever express an interest in their wider clan or their natural habitat, or do they ever express a need to travel or live elsewhere?
I don't think so. They really, really like looking at pictures of other bonobos and looking at books that have pictures of other bonobos. And in fact, they saw my cover before I did, and they gave the thumbs up because there's bonobos on it. But, the story behind that was that I hadn't seen the cover yet, and I was on a visit to the Trust, and so it was either have my editor next day to the Trust, or I had to wait 3 days and get it at home, and I didn't want to do that. So when the package came, somebody opened it, and there was my cover, so they gave it to the apes. And I wasn't completely sold on it yet, but the apes loved it, so there it is.
And the lady in the third row here.
Immediately after I finished Ape House, I read a book called Lucy by William Gonzalez. Mm-hmm. Do you know that book?
I have not read it. I actually went because there was a very famous chimpanzee in the 1970s named Lucy who was released, not re-released, but released into the jungle in adulthood and met a very sad fate. But yes, you're talking about the human bonobo hybrid. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which is really about what does it mean to be an ape? What does it mean to be a human?
Mm-hmm.
And I've read the two concurrently, which was, you know,
accidental.
But I finished yours and picked up his. So I wondered if you'd read it.
I haven't yet. I'm like 8 pages in, but then I had to go on tour. So.
Something to look forward to when it's over. Please join me in thanking Sarah Gruen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So as I mentioned, we are very pressed for time, and unfortunately Sarah's only going to have time to sign the books and not personalize. But we will see you upstairs.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.